In the infinite inning, people don't get you, even if you're good. Last week, a bravely anonymous member of the Yankees front office criticized 24-year-old first baseman Greg Bird for being on the disabled list, where he's been for all but the first 19 games of the season, having suffered a bruise on his right ankle after fouling a ball off of it in the last game of spring training. That doesn't seem like something that would keep you out for long, but Bird just hasn't been able to play without pain. As he told NewJersey.com this past weekend, "I feel pain in everything I do." Some in the front office are not buying it. Bill Madden of the New York Daily News wrote, "The Yankees brass has become exasperated with Bird, who's never been able to stay healthy, and it has gotten to the point where, if he doesn't get back on the field after the All-Star break, they are prepared to move him over the winter." Madden quotes someone he calls a Yankee insider as saying, "You really have to wonder what's up with this guy. You'd think with Judge and Sanchez, the guys he came up through the system with, doing so well up here, he'd want to be a part of this. Apparently not." It's not coincidental that this kind of sniping has happened during a stretch when the Yankees are sinking. Since June 1st, they've gone 15-21 and have dropped from leading the AL East by 4 games to looking up at the Red Sox by roughly the same margin. In the aftermath of Madden's report, Brian Cashman and Joe Girardi, the Yankees' general manager and manager respectively, said all the right things, but this is something that bad teams do. Incompetent leadership looks for someone to blame instead of taking responsibility. If you followed the Yankees long enough, you've seen this movie before. It happened with Ricky Henderson in 1987. The Yankees had the greatest leadoff hitter of all time, a guy who would crouch over so his strike zone was the size of a newborn kitten, hit 300, lead off games with home runs, steal more bases and score more runs than anybody in history. But he frustrated them. Ricky was an individualist and he had his own way of doing things. For example, he made it a point to always be the last, final player to report to spring training. He just wasn't into it. And sometimes he would take himself out of the lineup. Maybe his legs were beat up from so much running and sliding, or maybe, as he once said, he just wasn't mentally prepared to play. You can give him points for honesty, but obviously that kind of thing drives a manager crazy. Nevertheless, as we'll see momentarily, Ricky did want to play. He might have wanted to play more than anybody ever. Lou Piniella, his manager in 1987, didn't get that. The problem was a hamstring injury. Henderson and Piniella did not communicate well. In Henderson's As Told To autobiography, he says he was determined to win an MVP that year, and he got off to an incredible start. But his legs were hurting him. He sat out 4 games, but the Yankees rushed him back because he was so integral to their chances. On June 4th, the Yankees were in Milwaukee. They were trailing 9-3 in the 8th inning against Teddy Higuera, a pitcher they could never, ever touch. Henderson walked and was incredulous when Piniella flashed him the steal sign. Okay, orders are orders, he went. Something in the leg pops, he drops between first and second, has to leave the game. The Yankees called a hamstring strain, put him on the disabled list. He disappears for 22 games, which in calendar terms is about a month. Even when they activated him, he didn't feel ready. He was still in pain. He told the Yankees, but no one listened. The trainer and the team doctor were telling Piniella and owner George Steinbrenner that, regardless of what Henderson was saying, he was fine. Think about that. It's reminiscent of Oscar Levant's proposed epitaph for himself. "I told you I was sick." Predictably, he doesn't hit. In 22 games after coming off the DL, he hits .250 and slugs .307, and most tellingly, attempts only 5 steals. Rumors start appearing in the papers attributed to unnamed Yankee sources that Henderson is, quote, "jaking it." He doesn't want to play. He's just going through the motions. Finally, Henderson further aggravates the injury, misses a few days, and Piniella, without asking, puts him back in the lineup. Henderson says, "I'm sorry, I can't do that." Piniella is angry, and at least behind the scenes, if what George Steinbrenner said later is to be taken at face value, was insisting that Henderson be traded at the first opportunity. Steinbrenner himself weighed in at this time, and he tried to have it both ways. "I'm not ready to disable Ricky Henderson, and I'm not coming down on him at this point, but I will be upset Saturday if he's not ready. From the reports I'm getting, he should be ready to go full tilt by the weekend. If he says he can't play, and the doctor and trainer say he can, then he has a right to get his own opinion, and I'm going to demand that he do that. If there's a disagreement, then we'll get a third doctor to arbitrate it, and if the doctor says he can play, then I will consider a suspension." According to Madden's biography of Steinbrenner, the letter of suspension had already been drawn up and was merely awaiting the concurrence of the team doctor. And that doctor testified to Madden, he felt under no little pressure to go along. Fortunately, he didn't. At this point, it seems incredible that they waited this long. Henderson finally got checked out. The stories at the time called them X-rays. I don't know if they really were. I'm not sure what the availability of scanning technology was at that point. But whatever the diagnostic, it revealed that Henderson's hamstring was not strained, was not pulled, it was torn. At that point, Pinella very charitably allowed that the Yankees had decided that the best course of action where Ricky Henderson was concerned was to put him on the disabled list. Very generous. And here's the point. The passage of time hasn't made anyone who was involved in the criticism of Henderson look any better. Yeah, he was a bit strange. Yeah, he sat sometimes. But he really did want to play. Few players in the history of the game have hung on as tightly as Henderson did. Long after his peak, he was still playing. He went wherever he had to go. You've heard of the late nomadic phase of a player's career? Over the last 8 seasons of his time in the majors, Henderson went from the A's to the Padres to the Angels, back to the A's, across the continent to the Mets, then back across to the Mariners, down to the Padres, off to the East Coast again for a year with the Red Sox, and finally ended in Los Angeles again with the Dodgers. But he wasn't done. In 2004, he played with the Newark Bears of the Independent Atlantic League, still looking for another chance. In 2005, having not gotten it, he played with the San Diego Surf Dogs of the Independent Golden Baseball League. He was 46 years old, and all he wanted to do was play. Just in terms of major league games, he played 3,081 contests, fourth most all time. There's Pete Rose, Carl Yastrzemski, Hank Aaron, and Ricky. Basically, almost no one wanted to play more than Ricky Henderson did. It didn't express itself in Cal Ripken Ironman streaks. It expressed itself in a desperate longevity. So here's a warning to unnamed Yankees executives. Be careful when you criticize the kids because they're younger than you and they have a lot of time to prove you wrong. And whereas it's unlikely that Greg Bird winds up in Cooperstown, trading him in a fit of pique tempts fate in the exact same way. Steinbrenner and Pinella tried to shame Henderson, but as long as his Hall of Fame plaque hangs, he'll be shaming them. In a sense, then, he's still playing, and that means, for once, that everything is A-OK in the infinite inning. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Invading Venusians have overtaken the space station, but you rush to an escape pod and crash on a paradise planet where you quickly set up shop at an oasis that becomes known as Episode 12. Did you remember your toothbrush? The show I've prepared for you this week is a bit of a departure, but I trust you'll enjoy it. With the season frozen for the All-Star break and plenty of time in the weeks to come to discuss stretch drive news and trade rumors, which is all anyone's going to want to talk about at least through July 31st, I thought it would be interesting to take a break and look at things that you might have missed while your head was buried in the baseball season, specifically what's playing at the movies. And in pursuit of that goal, I have recruited my friend and colleague Scott Tobias. He not only writes well everywhere, but he's the editor of Oscilloscope Musings, a film essay site that I'm fortunate enough to write for from time to time. He was a 14-year writer at the AV Club, editor of the late lamented The Dissolve, which for a brief Camelot-like moment was home to the best film writing on the web, and presently is one of 4 co-hosts of the Next Picture Show podcast, which examines current films by comparing them, quite entertainingly, to their predecessors and antecedents. Along the way, you'll hear us talk about not only what's out there now and Scott's pick for the one must-see movie of the summer to date. We also discuss the superhero film phenomenon, a whole slew of failed wannabe blockbusters this year, and touch on why such a promising product as The Dissolve was not long for this world, and oh yeah, a lot of Albert Brooks. A whole lot of Albert Brooks. Before we get to that, though, I wanted to talk briefly about a column I wrote last week on the Cubs, which brought up just offhandedly a issue involving Babe Ruth, which attracted a reader comment. In the column, which discussed Theo Epstein taking responsibility for the Cubs' failures, I suggested that there were certain things that no general manager can anticipate, and I used an example, as I want to do, from the past. I wrote, When the New York Yankees went 69-85 in 1925, it wasn't that general manager Ed Barrow lacked the qualities that allowed him to put together pennant winners from 1921 to 1923 and again from 1926 through 1928, but that Babe Ruth had a severe ulcer or syphilis or both. He couldn't find a quality shortstop until late in the season, and even then the one he found wasn't ready. And there were a dozen or so other disappointments. Overall, though, the difference between the championship 1923 Yankees and the 1925 team wasn't holistic, but incremental. TLDR version, the best laid plans of mice and men often suffer hamstring pulls or venereal disease. This inspired a reader to comment on the piece. You can see it. I'll leave his name, although I believe it is appended to the comment. He wrote, and I sincerely thank him for this, "Excellent article, brilliant actually, but I could do without the speculation on Babe Ruth's venereal disease. It's not like speculating whether someone had a cold or the flu. Unless you have direct evidence, not hearsay, it's not fair to cast that shadow over a dead man, a much beloved one. You made an excellent point, but it could have been made without going there. Thank you." I welcome the comment. I welcome any comment that attempts to be constructive in some sense, instead of calling me an idiot in one fashion or another. But I do reject the premise. First of all, I don't think we have to be so precious about Ruth and venereal disease. I'm not suggesting that to retroactively stigmatize Ruth, but rather to suggest that unexpected and serious things can derail a player season, be that, as in our opening segment, a hamstring tear, or a divorce, or something as unusual but serious as venereal disease. The topic, after all, was what general managers do and do not have control over. What goes on in a player's, for want of a better term, nether regions is one of those areas that they exercise the least control. That was especially true in Ruth's case, where, married or not, and he was most often married during his Yankees career, he was an open and avid womanizer of both the pro and amateur variety. As for hearsay, I'm afraid that after 92 years, it's pretty much all we've got, but then it was all anyone had to go on even back when the story in question happened. For those who came in late, what we're referring to, me and I assume the commenter, is the so-called bellyache heard round the world of 1925. As briefly as I can detail this, that year, Ruth came to spring training, he had the flu. This was a typical thing, he seemed to get sick every spring throughout his career. In this instance, though, he was very sick. He told Miller Huggins he had a fever over 105 degrees, and he kept trying to play anyway. They back then thought you could sweat it out. But that proved to be almost a fatal mistake, as the Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers trained north together from spring training, playing exhibitions along the way. This was a typical practice at the time. Ruth collapsed in the train station at Asheville, North Carolina. He demanded to go home, so he was put on another train heading back to New York. Along the way, he felt well enough as the train was arriving at Penn Station in Manhattan to get up, comb his hair, and he went to the men's room and was left alone for a minute, and he collapsed. He fainted. He struck his head on the way down on a sink, and he was found that way by the Yankee scout Paul Critchell, who was accompanying him home. This was a big deal. By this time, the Asheville story had already circulated, and rumors that Ruth was dead, obituaries were actually printed, was going about in the papers. Well, he wasn't dead, but he was in very bad shape. As they're trying to figure out how to get him off the train, the narrow corridors wouldn't accommodate a stretcher. He goes into convulsions, he's thrashing about and yelling incoherently, they have to hold him down. And in fact, it takes forever to get him out of Penn Station, and between then and when he finally arrives at the hospital, he has convulsions 9 different times. This is somebody who, at the very least, has a high fever, is concussed, and is just in very serious overall shape. Now, initially, his doctors say he's fine. They've got him stabilized. Sure, he might have a touch of the flu, and he's, in general, exhausted and has overindulged himself in food and drink. This is where the bellyache idea comes from. And he just needs a little rest to clear all those hot dogs and soda pops out of his system, and then, sure, he'll be ready for opening day. Well, he wasn't ready for opening day, and in short order, the doctors kind of do a 180 and say, no, he's going to need a serious surgery to cure an intestinal abscess. And this did happen. Ruth had a scar, a long scar, for the rest of his life. People saw it, they can attest to it. Let me be more specific. They could attest to the scar and that it resulted from a surgery, but they could not attest to what the purpose of the surgery was. The handling of Ruth's illness in the press was very carefully controlled by the Yankees, and it raised the question of what was so troublesome about an intestinal abscess that the Yankees had to play things so close to the vest. Adding to this suspicion was the fact that the aforementioned Ed Barrow apparently confided in writers later on that Ruth did in fact have venereal disease, that the procedure was in relationship to that, and the 7 weeks that he ultimately spent in the hospital were as a result of his having that problem. Every major Ruth biography grapples with this question. And it's not just prurient interest that causes them to do so. It's an important episode in his life. First, 1925 was really the only off year of his career prior to 1934. That's kind of a big deal. And as a result, or partially as a result, the Yankees were a second division team for the only time during Ruth's residency. So that matters. Second, it goes to how hard the owner Jacob Rupert and Ed Barrow were against Ruth in terms of believing that he could manage or serve in some other executive capacity with the team, because as they often said, you can't take care of yourself, how can you take care of other people? Well, if they thought that he had made himself seriously ill by overindulging with women, and they probably would have been more inclined to be moralistic about that as compared to food, then it helps explain some of the tragedy of Ruth's later life, when he felt so bitter and frustrated and thwarted over his desire to have a further career in the major leagues. But to me, the point is even greater than that. The reason not to shy away from it, not to run away from it. And it's simply this. I kind of hope he had venereal disease, not because I retroactively wish ill on him or his many multitudinous sexual partners, but because perfect people are boring and unattainable. And the real value of heroes is not just their great moments, when they call their shot, when they rush into burning buildings, anything like that, that the normal person wouldn't do, but when they are the opposite, when they fail you in showing you that they have feet of clay. They are showing you not to blindly worship anyone. And more than that, they're showing you that sometimes their greatest characteristics emerge from their greatest flaws. Ruth's upbringing was Dickensian. I think it was super Dickensian. This is somebody who was an orphan, not because his parents were dead, but because they just couldn't deal with him. And he was orphaned not just once, but many times. He wasn't permanently incarcerated in that Baltimore orphanage. They kept sending him home, and his parents would just keep sending him back. Imagine the pain of that. And if he had outsized appetites afterward, and if he hit outsized home runs, it seems to me that those two things must go hand in hand some way. He loved kids, he loved signing autographs, but at the same time, he loved the attention. And the womanizing, that's about getting love that you couldn't receive in other ways also. And if, in the course of that quest to fulfill himself, to fill whatever gaps that painful childhood had given him, he contracted a serious illness, I don't think that's a flaw. I think it's a symptom of something even larger, something that helps us understand him and makes him yet more lovable than if we thought he was just 100% consistently a great guy who, yeah, had an intestinal abscess. So I don't want to apologize for this one. Our heroes are imperfect. That is what makes them heroes. Take them whole, not in sanitized parts, and they'll be that much more valuable to you because you'll understand not only their complexity, but your own and that of everyone around you. I'll be back with Scott Tobias in just a moment. So, as usual, this is a fraught introduction for me in that I've had a working relationship with the next voice you'll hear for over a year now, I think, writing the occasional essay for Oscilloscope Musings, which is the site that he edits and one of many hats that he wears. And that's a great site that covers all aspects of old movies. Recently, there's been a retrospective of Kennedy assassination films and a look back at the evolution of Stanley Kubrick's style, and pretty much anything you could imagine that covers movies that didn't happen today happens at that site. But we've never spoken before, so this could go really well, or for some reason we could dislike each other intensely. I can't imagine why, but this is live tape radio, so to speak. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing well. It's good to talk.
Great, and thank you for coming. As you know, this is normally a baseball podcast, a sports podcast, but it also wears many hats. We talk about writing a lot. We talk about editing. We occasionally digress into politics and other things because pretty much you can interpret almost anything through the metaphor of baseball. But one thing I want to ask you now that we're here at the All-Star break, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, is that for a lot of fans who are not the hardcore fan, they start to check out at this time because if you're a Phillies fan or a Giants fan or very possibly and strangely a Cubs fan, it may be over at this point. So what I wanted to ask you is what our alternatives are at the multiplex. But even before we get to that, I've become a big fan of the podcast that you co-host, the Next Picture Show podcast. And for those who haven't listened, I wanted to ask you what that was all about.
Well, the Next Picture Show podcast grew out of a site that the four of us used to have called The Dissolve that was that Pitchfork started and that ended after 2 years. And the core group of us, Keith Phipps, Genevieve Kosky, Tasha Robinson, and I had worked together for many, many years before that in the AV Club. It was probably, some of those relationships were 14 years old before we even started The Dissolve. And Genevieve was kind of the baby of the bunch, and we'd all worked with her for like 8 years. So we had a really strong working relationship. And when The Dissolve ended, that pretty much was, we weren't going to get a third site where we were all going to work together. That was pretty much the end of it. So our thought was like, let's continue working together. And of course, the podcasts you can do cheaply and no one is looking over your shoulder. And so we decided to start a podcast called The Next Picture Show under the Film Spotting family, I guess. So Film Spotting SVU and us. Our idea was to take a feature that we had running at The Dissolve called Movie of the Week and kind of build a podcast idea around that. It was sort of going to be a combination. It was originally pitched to us as a combination or developed as a combination of Movie of the Week at The Dissolve and You Must Remember This, Carino Longworth's great podcast. It was going to have strong historical context, a certain essayistic aspect of it as well as argument. And we were going to do what we always wanted to do on The Dissolve, which was to, when a new film came out, we always wanted readers to understand that, it didn't just come out of nothing, that films there's a long history there and there's context for everything. And so the podcast was born out of the idea that when something new comes out that we think is interesting, that we can look back on a related film that influenced it or shares a lot of things in common with it and give you that as well and kind of compare the two and how they overlap. And that's basically what the Next Picture Show turned out to be.
I love these juxtapositions. And just to tell people the last few, It Comes at Night was juxtaposed with John Carpenter's The Thing. And the week prior to that, it was Wonder Woman with Kubrick's Paths of Glory, which I was a little skeptical about. And I think you guys kind of pulled it off. Before that, Baywatch and the Brady Bunch movie, which at the very least reminded me of how amusing, I hate to admit it almost, it's almost embarrassing to admit how amusing and actually good the Brady Bunch movie was.
No, you shouldn't be embarrassed. It's really good. It's really smart. And it figured it out. It took what was a problem, which is we want to turn this popular product or not product, this popular thing in our archive, the Brady Bunch that everyone knows about, into a movie, but you couldn't possibly do a straight up adaptation of the Brady Bunch. And so it was a problem that kind of presented its own solution. Okay, let's make it as people, from the perspective of a modern viewer, we'll make it about how the Bradys haven't changed at all, but they're in a completely new place. They're in the 90s and they're fish out of water. And it's, it was a brilliant idea that paid off well in that film and did not work much at all in Baywatch, which sort of tried the same thing. Another kind of lousy TV show that they tried to make into a movie by making it kind of self-aware and funny and a little harder than it looks, I think.
Well, here's what I mean by embarrassed. I mean, first of all, if you're me and you look back on your life, and I think ballpark we're somewhere towards the same age, but I grew up and I spent inordinate, like all children, amount of time doing things that I am now embarrassed by. And among them would be probably watching the complete run of the Brady Bunch, mm-hmm. like 10 times in syndication, mm-hmm. just reflexively, and then playing things like Atari 2600 games, which it is really hard to justify because they're a bunch of blocks.
Yeah.
And so
we are incidentally, we must be the same age because I did the exact same thing. I also had the Atari, and I also had watched the Brady Bunch and other. I mean, I was talking the other day about all these cruddy shows that I watched every episode of Family Ties and Silver Spoons and all that. I mean, I watched all that stuff. The Growing Pains. I mean, they're all terrible shows if you actually go back and watch any of them. But
well, now as an adult, I look at my bookshelves and I say, why haven't you read the complete works of Tolstoy, Steve? And the answer is because I took that time and I applied it to approximately 1,000 hours of the Brady Bunch. And when I go to a theater, and this is something also that I, as a critic, that is worth asking you about. There are movies that you go to that you feel guilty about going to sometimes. And of course, for you, it's your job. Mm-hmm. But I remember when I was in college, a friend of mine said Basic Instinct came out, and the movie with the infamous Sharon Stone genital reveal and, sure. and everything, and the Joe Esterhaus script and everything. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, and I'm not just alibiing, I really did get my arm twisted into seeing it.
Oh my gosh.
And I saw it in a full theater, and it was the most interesting experience because whenever something that was supposed to be sexy happened or incredibly arousing happened, people giggled. And it was because they all knew why they were there. They would not necessarily have gone to see this film if they had not heard that it was incredibly prurient, if it was not incredibly titillating. And I came out of that, and it wasn't a very good film in my opinion. Hmm. And I came out of it feeling like, let's all admit, if we all would just admit that we want to see pornography, then we can go see pornography and not feel embarrassed about it. But if you have this halfway measure where you're in kind of a communal experience with people and you're watching something and you feel sort of weird, like, you know, you wouldn't want your mother to know that you're looking at Sharon Stone's private parts or anything, then the experience is neither fish nor fowl. It's a weird disconnect. And it's almost the same thing with the Brady Bunch, because even though it was like I know that's a weird combination to make,
yeah.
but in that somehow I feel weird admitting that I know the entire Brady Bunch continuity, like I know the entire Star Trek continuity, another thing I saw, several times over. And then to say to your friends or your family, I really want to go to the theater and see the Brady Bunch adaptation. I want to double down on this Brady Bunch experience.
You said a lot here. I really like Basic Instinct, but I'm a Paul Verhoeven fan, and but I get the phenomenon you're talking about is, I mean, that's the movies to me, and it's like it almost becomes sort of a secret thing for writers, especially because we are drawn to the movies by things that are often prurient and sensual and not really that sophisticated, but we kind of have to find some sort of language to make it seem like a legitimate enterprise, or to not, I mean, we can't just, if you're drawn to a movie like Basic Instincts because it's sexy, it's you really can't write that. it's very hard so you have to kind of find some sort of language to justify or account for feelings that, are kind of, for lack of a better word, base. And it's something I've kind of struggled with recently in the controversial that's sort of brewed up around David Edelstein's review of Wonder Woman about the way he was talking about women. And it's just there's a thing where I look at that review and think, well, that it was misjudged and that there's language in there that I wouldn't use and it was sort of sexist. But at the same time, how do you account for how you feel about this beautiful, scantily clothed Amazonian, Amazon demigoddess, running around the screen, the big screen for 137 minutes. I mean, that's kind of, so it's one of those things where it's such an essential part of movie going, that being drawn to the sin in cinema, but having to try to find, to sort of tiptoe around that or to be almost, feel like ashamed to be drawn to that. It's just, I don't know. Maybe it's part of just the American puritanical mindset. I don't know, but it presents almost a critical problem for me sometimes, is trying to account for why the movies are sometimes really compelling in a really base way.
That's a really, as like you said, as a writerly problem, and the Edelstein review of Wonder Woman certainly did ignite a lot of criticism. And I thought back to the late Roger Ebert, the deservedly revered Roger Ebert, who reviewing, I remember this so clearly because it seemed odd even then, but nobody said anything. He was reviewing one of the early Harry Potter films, and he referred to Emma Watson as being in a, quote, early stage of babehood, unquote. And obviously you caught it because you knew what I was about to say, but I feel like that sailed by at the time. And here he's talking about a woman who was not a woman, who was underage, who was a child. Mm-hmm. And it seemed very discordant, and yet it's not necessarily – the word babe is certainly loaded, but it's not necessarily salacious to say that she was an attractive young actress. That's obviously one of the reasons why she was cast. And I, if you stop there, is it okay?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, that's definitely a line being crossed. But I think the culture has changed, and perhaps for the better, in that those sorts of that people are getting called out for that kind of thing. Because I guess that Ebert thing, I don't remember anybody saying anything about it at the time, as you say. But I am aware of it. And I think I became aware of it pretty recently. So. I make of that what you will, I guess.
Before I get any more sidetracked, which is a hallmark of mine, as you know from my writing, is probably a hallmark of mine everywhere, having a naturally discursive or digressive mind, let's start on the actual first mission statement that I gave you. This has been a summer of, it feels like in large part, unasked for sequels, which moviegoers have in large numbers rejected. Some have landed, say the second Guardians of the Galaxy picture, or the expansions of the DC and Marvel universes that are the Wonder Woman and Spider-Man films. But those aside, or even and maybe especially superhero films aside, I mean, feel free to list them if they've made your kind of overall list. But what have you seen this summer, whether in terms of pictures that are out or are imminently coming out, that would serve as a good alternative to a failed baseball season?
Okay. What have I liked, in other words?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, this is actually the right time to go. I think the summer started really, really poorly with, you know, a lot of films that did not succeed for good reason. Films like King Arthur, for example, or the fifth Pirates of the Caribbean movie. I actually found a lot of things to like about Alien Covenant, but The Mummy was a disaster, and I thought Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was sort of the first one again. I didn't feel like there was anything that exciting about it. But now we're starting to get, you know, I was sort of relieved to see Wonder Woman, because just by for it being a competent, right, well-told story. It's not a great film by any stretch, but like it kind of got the job done and delivered in a way that no film was delivering. But I think we're starting to get a little bit of artistry now. Baby Driver being kind of a big example, yes, of that. That was really exciting. And then, you know, on the horizon, I've heard, I haven't seen yet War for the Planet of the Apes, but by all accounts, it's supposed to be superb. I'm excited about Dunkirk. It's coming up. And then there are a lot of films that are, you know, just floating around in art houses here and there that are worth checking out. I thought The Beguiled by Sofia Coppola was a pretty strong effort. Again, I've heard good things about The Big Sick. I haven't seen that yet. It's starting to get a little bit more interesting, but it's taken some time. It's been a really quite a bad summer until very, very recently.
Before we got online here, I looked back at a summer movie preview that Entertainment Weekly published, and in fact a slideshow, which I normally avoid for reasons of personal taste, but they had listed, this was back in April, they had listed 29 films that they had were, quote, most looking forward to. And on that list, fully a third of the list basically was Snatched with Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn, with Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler, okay, The Book of Henry, which has gotten some truly epical reviews by the future Star Wars director, Baywatch, the Transformers picture, the Pirates of the Caribbean picture, The Mummy with Tom Cruise, King Arthur, which you already mentioned, and the Alien film, and the Alien film, and I'm not just saying this because you liked it, was not quite in the ballpark of those films in terms of reviews. The reviews on Alien Covenant were more split between people who kind of liked it and those who didn't. The others were, at least critically, huge flatliners.
Yeah.
And so I'm not trying to say that Entertainment Weekly is somehow tone deaf or that they overly shill for middle of the road Hollywood product. I mean, maybe they do. I don't know. But I'm just wondering if, like, we've had just an unusually high percentage of misses like that this year.
Yeah, I think we have had. I think they have. There have been more misses. I think you can kind of see it coming. I mean, all of those films you mentioned, you know, I don't really like to prejudge too much, but I mean, you do get a sense of the pedigree of the people involved, and you know, you can look a Guy Ritchie King Arthur movie that doesn't sound very promising to me. A fifth Transformers movie that doesn't sound very promising either. Baywatch certainly doesn't sound. You know what I mean? Like, these are, you know, a fifth Pirates of the Caribbean movie. It's not really hard to predict that these films might not turn out to be, you know, as great. I mean, they didn't sound good to begin with, so I don't really get even from a summer movie preview perspective that there was a whole lot of promise with these movies to begin with. I don't think there's really been anything surprising in terms of what films haven't been that good. I think maybe you could be a little surprised that Wonder Woman turned out to be as solid as it was, because that, at least for a stretch, had some pre-release buzz that there were some issues behind the scenes, you know, that nothing, a lot, some things needed to be worked out, or, you know, had some, you know, the DC Warner Brothers thing that wasn't as worked out as well as Marvel, and maybe that whole production system was going to fail. I mean, you could maybe be surprised by that, but all these other titles that you mentioned, none of those sounded good, and none of those turned out to be good.
I enjoy big action movies. There's still enough of a kid, and I'm certainly still enough of a comic book guy and that kind of thing to enjoy those kinds of films. But I think what increasingly bothers me, and this becomes almost an issue of balance in the films where the plotting or characterization aren't as strong, is that for vast moments of these movies, you're not really seeing the actors. You're not really seeing anything except cutscenes from video games, basically. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, how many minutes of an Iron Man movie Robert Downey Jr. is actually in compared to, say, some animation of him flying around in the suit with a voiceover. and again, those things can be fun in context, but when something increasingly becomes that, when there's really nothing more to a film than that, it seems almost like the cake is all icing and no cake. You don't have any substance to glom onto, and it just becomes too much of a spectacle with no content attached.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to speak generally about my problem, specifically with Marvel movies, is that they're too controlled, too homogenous in terms of in style, which is by design. They're very much producers movies in a director's medium, and so they all have the same look and the same tone. And, as you know, just a sameness that is satisfying to a degree, but it's sort of a high floor, low ceiling type of situation with Marvel. I'm grateful for superhero films that kind of play around a little bit on the outside of that. I mean, I quite liked Logan. Did you see Logan earlier this year?
Yes, I did.
I mean, I thought that was its own thing. I mean, that was from James Mangold. It had a real strong, it was played like a Western. It had a pace that was different from other superhero movies. It had a style that was different from other superhero movies. I mean, it's been released in black and white, which kind of gives you an idea of where his head might have been at. You know, it's got that whole sequence on the farm was just, I thought, really haunting and just unusual. I mean, something you don't see. You know, the incident I always kind of come back to when it comes to Marvel is when Edgar Wright was fired or left Ant-Man. I thought that was kind of a telling moment, because that was a point where Marvel could have played a little bit and could have let an auteur of sorts do his own thing, make his own movie that might be a little bit different from the house style, and that seemed to make them uncomfortable enough to where they parted ways. And that was a telling moment and a kind of a poor moment and dispiriting moment for Marvel.
Absolutely. And you took the words out of my mouth on that. And you mentioned Baby Driver before, which is a really entertaining movie. But I felt bad for Edgar Wright doing some of the publicity on that because Ant-Man just kept coming up. Mm-hmm. And it felt like everybody wanted him to be bitter about that or have some comment on it. Are you still thinking about Ant-Man? No, not really. Have you seen Ant-Man? No. Do you spend your every waking moment thinking about Ant-Man with deep regret? It's a shame in a way because Baby Driver, you know, is maybe not the most original movie you've ever seen. And I think it's telling in a way, in a good way, that among the thank yous and the credits were Quentin Tarantino and Martin Prest, who was the director of Beverly Hills Cop a million years ago, in that these are the kinds of guys who either made 30 some years ago or are still making those kinds of action comedies that seem to come to life in the 1980s. This is a much more unusual thing that we're seeing in that movie, at least for today, whereas the superhero films are ubiquitous. So why do we need to keep dragging the topic back to that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I didn't get a chance to interview him for the movie, and I wouldn't. He's like, there's like a handful of people. Fortunately, because I live in Chicago, there's not more who I know personally that I generally recuse myself of writing about in a professional capacity, and he's one of them. I'm sure, you know, the Ant-Man thing I think was a heartbreaking affair for sure for him and probably irritating for folks to bring it up. But I kind of know what you mean in a sense. Like, one of the things that I always kind of joke about is how you see this a lot in kind of dumb culture articles about how certain filmmakers should be making comic book movies. Like that's the pinnacle of artistic expression. Like, you know, like Lynn, like, you know, you'll see an article about, you know, women, certain, you know, a list of women who should be directing superhero movies. And you'll see names like, you know, Lynn Ramsey on there or something, where people who have absolutely no interest whatsoever, you know, Sofia Coppola or something like that. You know, it's just let them be artists. If Edgar Wright was not allowed to be Edgar Wright, then I mean, that is too bad. I mean, he is nothing if not engaged in pop culture and perfectly suited to do a really fun Ant-Man movie. But it's a shame that the system is so painfully conservative that it can't allow a vision a little funkier than what ultimately is a television show. Like, that's the problem with the Marvel movies is that they're produced like television shows where you can just bring on different filmmakers, but it's the same template. So they really can't do anything different with it. And that's how television is made. A template is established, you know, from the beginning, and you can bring on all sorts of different directors, but they have to work within that template. They can do some really cool original things in it, like Rian Johnson did in his Breaking Bad episodes, and Michelle McLaren did in her Breaking Bad episodes. But ultimately, you know, you've got this. You have to work in the house style, and that's something we're used to seeing on TV. But now, you know, that aesthetic has been translated into you know, these movies, and it's unfortunately it's a model that's made a huge amount of financial sense because you know, they continue to pay off, and that kind of conservatism, aesthetic conservatism, you know, isn't being discouraged, I guess, by, you know, the numbers and the people who are turning out to see them.
You pointed out before that they're being made as producer films rather than director films, and that harks back to old Hollywood in a way, where you had these studio heads going back to Irving Thalberg and guys like that, where they're dictating the look and film of the look and feel of the films. They're dictating the casting. They're even doing edits and cuts. And so I can kind of understand the quality control that comes with having a house style. But at the same time, there were outliers even in that system. And those producers knew well enough that if they were going to hire an Alfred Hitchcock or a John Ford or a Howard Hawks, and these guys, as time went on, had their own production companies that would then contract to work within the studio system. And I mean, they did occasionally get jerked around on endings and casting and things like that. But on the whole, you understood that you were hiring those guys for a reason. You wanted them to be the auteurs of those movies. That was the benefit that you were going to reap. So it's weird that, like, right now the intake for these systems, as you said, is to take a director who makes a successful small film, an artistic or an original film, and then kind of suck him into these, and again, I like superhero films, but to suck him into this homogenizing system. And, you know, like, look at what we saw with, say, Josh Trank on the Fantastic Four film 2-3 years ago, where This was a guy who had done something independent, and either he wasn't equipped by whether through temperament or through artistic vision to make the film that Fox, it wasn't a Marvel Studios, but Fox wanted him to make. And the whole thing became disastrous, and he just didn't need to have been there in the first place.
Well, maybe. I don't know if in his case, he had done something.
Chronicle, right?
Chronicle. I don't think Chronicle is all that far removed interest-wise from what he did, and neither is the director who did Godzilla. And I mean, I always think that's almost a separate issue in that I don't think these directors are being... I think these directors are actually auditioning almost for to make these types of movies. I don't think they're being kind of like wedged into... You know, Colin Trevorrow, I don't feel like we're missing some sort of incredible... independent career here. Plainly, that's not the case. I don't think we're missing anything from the 500 Days of Summer guy when he goes off and does a couple of Spider-Mans. I don't. Mark Webb, I guess his name is.
Yes.
Maybe the name Webb is what drew people to make drew the studio to making Spider-Man movies with him. But I don't know. You know, a lot of the times you look at independent films and you're like, this is just like a deal. Like we're watching like a demo reel here for somebody who's trying out to direct something bigger. So I guess what I would worry about more would be somebody who believe it or not, you know what, I'm gonna say something bold. Somebody like Rian Johnson, for example, he's spending however many years of his life making this new Star Wars movie, which I'm sure will be terrific. He's a terrific director, but that means it's costing us another Brick or another Looper or another even Brothers Bloom, if you're kind of into that. I mean, that's somebody who has a really distinct vision, who could be doing other films, other original films, other substantive films, if he weren't kind of sucked into this Star Wars universe. Though I think this is kind of a one-time thing. He'll probably find his way back into making sort of the quirky, layered science fiction that he and genre film he built his reputation on. But other times, independent films just feel like a stepping stone to a Hollywood career. I always resented those types of movies. My inner indie guy is thinking of them as careerists.
You'd think there'd be more room for that. More room for, because the bets on these films are so big, and under the studio system, they would hedge their bets with cheaper films, essentially. And that way, if you took a loss on one big one, maybe you'd get something on three small ones. And if you can make your money on like a La La Land, which didn't cost nearly what some of these big event films make, essentially, if you're happy with a smaller profit margin and fewer theme park rides, we could have more variety on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, that's just not the way it works. I mean, there's just too much at stake, and so everything has to be big. Even small films have to be made in big, outrageous ways. I mean, you think about what has been at like a hit comedy. What blockbuster comedy looks like, it's huge. I mean, like the Hangover movies or Neighbors or some of these Paul Feig movies like Bridesmaids, they're full of these huge comic set pieces that are sort of outrageous and get people talking, and in some cases cost a lot of money to stage. Again, there becomes a sameness with those too, of like what kind of comedy do we have to do, or what kind of horror film do we have to do, like The Conjuring, say, to bring in these types of numbers, these insane blockbuster numbers, and it affects movies big and relatively small. I think as far as stuff like La La Land and Moonlight, I mean, these are all films that are produced independently or semi-independently and released through studio boutique arms like Fox Searchlight or A24, which is not really a studio, but it has a little bit more muscle than your pure independent. I mean, that's how these films get out. So if you want to see films that are have a certain amount of personality, it's very hard to find them in coming out of studios now, except for Baby Driver's stuff. Exciting.
And what I wonder, since I was thinking about Baby Driver as you were talking about that, and I mentioned Martin Brest before, who made Beverly Hills Cop, and that was maybe the second film in kind of a cycle, an 80s cycle, which I guess began with 48 Hours, which was a couple of years before, also an Eddie Murphy film. And they combined really, ultra-realistic Sam Peckinpah-type violence with comedy in a way that hadn't really done before. Like a Jerry Lee Lewis movie, Jerry Lewis, is not, not going to have somebody's brain splattered on a window or someone, you know, squibs of blood flying everywhere. There was a clear demarcation between that movie and say an action film. Now you're combining the two. And that led to a great many films in that genre, some very good, some very forgettable, including all the Beverly Hills Cop sequels. Mm-hmm. But it seems, I don't know, it seems like they more or less vanished or became less of an event. And what I kind of wonder is, at this stage of things, with special effects and the superhero films and all of that, I wonder if the money to stage, say, huge car chases like in Baby Driver just gets piled into that end of things and these kinds of more grounded comedy action films get squeezed out.
You probably so, though I will note that, you know, if you talk about the 80s buddy action comedy, I mean, 48 Hours was a big moment, of course, and that's Walter Hill, and it's fantastic. But Lethal Weapon was the other, was kind of the big bang moment as well, and that was written by Shane Black, who, of course, last year did what I thought one of the best, if not the best, Hollywood movie of the summer, and The Nice Guys, which was a throwback, which was him, you know, doing the buddy action movie again, you know, and doing it through a studio miraculously. And of course, nobody turned out to see it, so I don't know if it's a model for success, but it was kind of great to see him do his thing. And of course, then he did it on a somewhat smaller scale again for Warner Brothers earlier with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Right. I don't know if you're, which yes. I also, he's great too, because he's somebody who really has a sense of classic Hollywood. I mean, that in noir especially, and loves language and gives you a lot of, you know, richness if you're really looking for it in terms of literary and filmic references, you know, in addition to just wit and fun. But it's hard, you know. I mean, you look for these things. You look for, like, personality when it comes. I mean, I have a thing where I tend to like or look forward to August the most of any month of the summer, just because it's where all the misfits go. And sometimes those misfits are really compelling, and if they might be flawed or just not really in step with the marketplace. But, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of something like Jonathan Demme's last film with Meryl Streep.
Ricky and the Flash. I just saw that.
The Flash, which I really think is quite good.
I really enjoyed it, yes.
Yeah, and it's so much a Jonathan Demme movie, and it came out, you know, through a studio at the end of the summer, and I've come to kind of look forward to that, you know, and even kind of look forward to movies that are just utter disasters in a way, you know, like there just seem to be this kind of weird story behind them, and you can kind of see they're this dysfunctional creation lurch around the screen. I like it. I mean, it's fascinating to watch. I mean, and you look at the end of this summer, you know, there's a lot of really cool stuff coming out. There's the new Catherine Bigelow film, Detroit. There's Steven Soderbergh's long-awaited return to actual film instead of television, called Logan Lucky. And that could be good. I mean, these could be a fun, you know, and the Glass Castle, which is a new film from Destin Daniel Cretton, who did a very interesting movie called Short Term 12 a few years ago. I mean, you know,
that was a great film also.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, and even something like, I haven't seen it yet, but this Luc Besson movie, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. I mean, that has to be interesting one way or the other, right? I mean, that's not going to be a boring film. I think it's going to be, maybe it will be a total fiasco, but I bet it'll be interesting.
It looks very garish, and that shouldn't be surprising given who it's coming from. But you're right. It will be arresting to look at, regardless of whether it's good or bad. And I did want to mention regarding Ricky and the Flash that my only disappointment with that film, and it may be idiosyncratic to me, is I figured Jonathan Demme movie, it's got a wedding in it. Robin Hitchcock showed up at the end of Rachel Getting Married. Maybe he'll show up at the end of this one. Spoilers, he does not. And it wouldn't have been it would have ruined the plot, actually, had he, without giving away the ending of the movie. His spot was taken by one of the major characters in the film. But it was a very entertaining movie, a well-acted movie. It's great to see Kevin Kline kind of in a low key mode, like not doing kind of full on comedy Kevin Kline, which can sometimes be a little overbearing if Academy Award winning. But before we get back to other stuff that's coming out, I do want to ask you about The Dissolve a little bit, because even before I knew you, I was a huge fan of that site. And I was a fan of you and the other principals at the site going back to the AV Club. And I'm sure you've heard this over the years, but for me as a reader of you, it was an odd experience, because pretty much all these people that I had kind of picked out at the AV Club as people I liked, enjoyed reading, respected their opinions, kind of all at once got up and inexplicably walked out and were just gone. Which, as somebody who has been worked as an editor, who has been on the publication side, that must have been a very scary period or difficult period for everybody, because you don't normally just get to decapitate a publication like that.
It kept going, though. It's not like, you know, it felt like the end of the world, but they kept rolling along. The publication is always going to be bigger than the people in it, for better or worse.
Well, that's true. I mean, I still enjoy it, and I don't want to put you in the position of bad-mouthing someplace that was your home for 14 years. I don't mean to do that. I don't feel like I have developed the same readerly bond with anybody who's come after.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's obviously quite a bit of a story there. What really started it was there was a bit of a conflict in terms of editorial direction. So I'll be as vague as possible as to what that conflict was. And the conflict was, broadly speaking, between the old guard and the new guard, and the old guard lost that battle. And Keith Phipps, he left the AV Club right at the end of the year we started The Dissolve, which would have been 4.5 years ago, is when he left. And he came to the Pitchfork people, Chris Caskey, with a big idea, which was Pitchfork for film. That was the idea. He had the people that he wanted all picked out and ready to go. And those people were all of us, all of the, you know, myself and Tasha Robinson and Nathan Rabin and Genevieve Kosky and Noel Murray. And then a couple of freelancers on top of that who would be working pretty regularly. And that was going to be the kind of the core. And then we brought in Matt Singer. Matt Singer was of the original seven people who were on full time. He was the one person that we brought in from the outside to handle the news section, and he did a fantastic job with that. And we basically just were able to, it was like a dream come true in a way, because we were able to develop the site exactly as we had envisioned it, with support but no interference from Pitchfork proper, and with incredible resources with their design and development team. They built a really beautiful site, and honestly, I never considered that it would not be a success, which is a little weird, because I felt like The Dissolve fit a gap in what was being done as far as film coverage goes. I mean, that there really wasn't a daily film site that was properly, that was coherent and properly staffed. I mean, you had some sites that were like IndieWire that had certainly a lot of presence, but they were a little bit disorganized in terms of some elements were very sort of bloggy and vaguely connected to IndieWire. It was not really, you know, a bunch of people working together as a team, as a unit, putting out a coherent, balanced film publication. And so that was our idea with The Dissolve. And, you know, and we were told to take it, that we had all kinds of time just to make it, to develop it and you know, sort of organically gain in readership. And you know, I think the market sort of surprised everyone in a tough way. Ultimately, we thought that it was going to be a huge advantage that we're doing this completely independently, very small scale, you know, no kind of like corporate succubus that was going to be above us taking all of the money away. It was just going to be really, everybody had a role to play. It made a lot of sense. There was balance, and it was frugal, but that's not how you can succeed. What in fact succeeds in terms of digital publishing now are gigantic entities. Those were the places that started to get, you know, suck up all of the advertising dollars. I mean, even for Pitchfork proper, I think, though I don't want to speak out of school on that, but I mean, the fact that they're they're a Condé Nast company after being Pitchfork for as long as the internet seemed to exist, I think tells you something about, you know, the changes that happened quite rapidly while we were there. Anyway, that's a kind of a long-winded story. You might have follow-up questions, but ultimately, you know, what was joyous about it was that we got to get together and plot out every aspect of that site, you know, every feature that we wanted to do, you know, how we wanted to approach things editorially. We had a system set up to where, you know, there are four of us in the editorial staff. Keith was the editor-in-chief, I was the editor, and then we had Genevieve and Tasha were also editors. And basically, we had it set up to where every feature went through three editors, and every review went through at least two editors. And so there was a tremendous amount of attention to detail, to making sure that we got facts right. I mean, it's just those sort of details that people don't really care about all that much. And no,
I do.
But yeah, I know. And I think the readers who really do care about it, I mean, the site is, you know, may have had a limited impact generally, but the people who love the site and loved it in the way that we wanted them to and that we designed the site to be loved. And so we left feeling like we had sort of a beautiful corpse. And it's a corpse that Pitchfork was kind enough to allow people to view. They did not boot it off the internet. It is there, you know, so you can go and look at everything that we wrote, and all of us gave full effort. You know, it was a nights and weekends type of job for me. It aged me years, probably. It was a lot of stress, but I mean, I think I feel proud of what we did and that we didn't really compromise.
That layer of editorial says something to me, because every publication I've ever worked at, editorial is a cost center, and you can argue about quality control. And I mean, when I was at Baseball Prospectus, the argument was always fire the editors and hire more interns. And that was devastating, because interns just don't have the eye and the experience to be developmental editors. And I'm not just talking about typos, and I don't think you are either. You're talking about shaping the stories, improving the content, finding holes in them, finding ways that things could be written better or further researched or become sharper so that they're the best, most polished piece you can put out there. And that's not something that people who finance these kinds of businesses will ever get, but it's a value that almost chokes me up. It's such a beautiful goal.
Yeah. As a writer, one comes to appreciate having that kind of support, because, you know, if you're, say, I mean, you know, for one, you could make mistakes that get caught, which is great. And then the other thing is that if you're trying to make an argument and that argument is way out of line, right, your editors can catch that and develop the piece and try to say, well, maybe you missed something here, or this you need to develop this part of the argument. This doesn't make any sense. You felt that protected in a way. I look at the way things are now, especially in terms of hot takes. They don't seem like these pieces. They seem like they get kind of a once over, and the writer especially is left just dangerously exposed by some bad idea they're advancing that might have been shot down before it even had a chance to be developed. So that was always important to us, and just trying to get things right. And I, as a writer now, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to find work at a lot of good publications with a lot of editorial backstop. And there was a piece the other day, like the first feature I ever wrote for the Los Angeles Times, I mentioned some sort of a mountain range, an obscure mountain range in Lapland that was featured in this movie. My editor sent me this note that the copy editor had written about how they went through multiple atlases from going back decades, and how this was the first time, you know, this specific mountain range had been mentioned in the 130 some year history of the Los Angeles Times. It was kind of cool that this person like went on a journey just to check this tiny fact that I don't think many would find that consequential. But I think on balance, it is consequential to have that kind of ethic in place. It's important.
Again, as a writer and editor, I greatly empathize with what you described with the Dissolve, where I feel like you did everything right, and just for whatever reason, it didn't click. And certainly we see that in movies sometimes. And with movies that we know are great or can write impassioned pieces arguing are great, but don't make the great box office for whatever reason. The Dissolve, ironically, was kind of in that position. And yet it really was some of the best, if not the best, daily film writing on the internet. And so I wonder if you feel like, having had that experience, that there is a market for really good writing online.
I don't know. I just don't know if it's as sustainable as a business. And I'm kind of happy that we didn't try to do certain things to kind of to make us more clicky, I guess, or to do things that would have felt a little bit like selling out or selling short our vision, because I don't think it would have mattered. I think there are structural reasons why some publications succeed and others don't. My moonshot idea, what I want to see happen, is sort of a Grantland that you pay for, right? Like, just like in terms of just get that kind of assemblage of the top culture writers around and make people pay for it like they pay for the New York Times. You know what I mean? Like, just, I think that there might be something there. If you have enough of an all-star cast in those roles, that there might be some impetus. I mean, because people pay for the New York Times or the Washington Post because they're the best, you know, and they've got all the resources and they're breaking big stories. And so that's what you pay for. The New Yorker, you pay for that. I think you could probably, that's a model that you could potentially apply to culture writing. Potentially that would be successful. But as far as like, you know, a site where you're doing a whole lot of writing and people are reading it for free and you're supposed to be paying for decent salaries and benefits and, you know, solid freelance wages, it's just, I don't see how it works. I really don't. I've been in the business for quite a while, and I don't see it. I don't see how the current model would support such a venture. You have to be big. And so we've almost gone to a point where, you know how magazines, there was sort of magazines that had that a thing where there are a lot of general interest magazines, and then it became like a niche industry. Right. We're kind of seeing that in reverse, where you're getting something niche has become general and more general. I mean, you know, a lot of times you'll get the same story just cut different ways. You know, it's, you know what I'm saying? Just kind of like they have their own house way of dealing with the same phenomena. That can be pretty depressing as well. But I just don't think with the Dissolve specifically, I look back on it and there was just no chance we could have done anything to stave off the inevitable. The only thing we could have done is if we started potentially as a film and TV site, I think there would have been some potential there, because more people, you know, watch and engage in television writing and television discussion than film.
Right.
Online, but that's not the way we went. So there was some talk about expanding into TV, but we never had the opportunity to do that.
It's still something I think, regardless, you can always be proud of having helped start and been associated with it. And it is very fondly remembered, not least by me. So we're coming up on an hour, and I'm leery of keeping you longer, and I appreciate your time so far. I do want to mention this, because this must be an incredibly neat thing, an honor, neat understates it, for someone who writes movie criticism. You've gotten to do the liner notes for a forthcoming Criterion release, and not just any Criterion release, because every once in a while, you know, the Criterion guys will kind of bring a movie into the Hall of Fame that you're not really sure how they, and I know that Criterion is not equivalent to the Hall of Fame, but they are very discerning, so it seems like that. Mm-hmm. But for a fairly special one, Albert Brooks's Lost in America. And so my first question is, obviously, did you get to speak with Mr. Brooks?
Believe it or not, no. But here's here's the thing. This is kind of how this developed. He suggested me for the piece, apparently. This is what I'm told. I still haven't talked to him about it. I interviewed him once. Well, let me go back a little bit. When I was in grad school in cinema studies, working on my master's degree, which I never finished because I got brought up. This is in 99. I got brought up to work for the AV Club full time. My thesis was on what at that time was the five films written and directed by Albert Brooks. I was a chapter or two into this thesis before I left. But in any case, so he came to town in support of the film Searching for Comedy in the Muslim World. And I interviewed him for that. We got along well. I asked a lot of questions that I think he was happy to answer. I mean, you've been in a situation where you're interviewing somebody, they kind of get a sense that at least that you know your stuff.
Right.
And I certainly, when it comes to Albert Brooks, I knew, you know, what I was talking about. And you know, Searching for the Comedy in the Muslim World references a lot of comedy routines that Brooks did before he even made movies. And I knew all those because I'd studied those, and I was just a huge fan. So in any case, you know, and I mentioned to him at the end of the interview that I had worked on this thesis, right? And this is like, I don't know, when is this? That's like 15, that's what, 15 years ago that film came out?
2005.
Oh, 2005. So right. So less than 12 years ago. So 12 years ago, and he remembered. We had done also, myself and Nathan Rabin had also done something called Primer that we did, a feature we did for AV Club. We did one on Albert Brooks, and he was very, I think, pleased with that. Based on those two experiences, he suggested, brought my name up to them as somebody who could write about Lost in America. And I got, you know, I mean, he's one of my personal heroes to be able to, I mean, for one, just, I'm just excited that the film is getting this kind of acknowledgement, because Criterion does seem like canonization to me.
Right.
So that was exciting enough, but to be a part of that in any way, doesn't get any better than that. I think he's a great comic genius, specifically as a film director, as a film writer and director, and star, way underappreciated. How rigorous and smart and, you know, uncompromising he is. I think he's brilliant, and so obviously I was excited to do Lost in America, and I worked really hard on it, and I'm pretty pleased with the way it turned out. So comes out at the end of this month, July. So I'm excited.
That's a really awesome thing, and I wonder where you would rank Lost in America among the now seven films that he's written and directed. I haven't seen it for a very long time. I've seen others more recently. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that sticks in my mind above all else is Gary Marshall, of all people.
Of course.
And his big climactic scene in that movie. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but anyone who thinks of Gary Marshall as the director of Pretty Woman or some of these prior to his death a couple of years ago, some of these sort of holiday-oriented kind of mainstream semi-schlocky comedies.
Mm-hmm.
He just has a one of the funnier cameos that you'll see in any movie in this picture.
Yeah, he and Sidney Pollack both. Sidney Pollack is another director who could always turn up in a movie and knock your socks off as an actor. I mean, think of him in Tootsie or in Husbands and Wives or right. in Eyes Wide Shut. I mean, just terrific. But yeah, I bet The Desert Inn Has Heart, that whole scene, I think is probably the most famous scene in Lost America. But I think those first five films that he wrote and directed are, I mean, that's the real, you know, meat of the work. And to me, as far as favorites go, I mean, I Modern Romance is kind of the towering achievement for me of that period. I mean, not to diss Lost America, which is also brilliant, but Modern Romance is just so uncompromising and so, like, his willingness, Brooks's personal willingness to, his total lack of vanity as a performer, his willingness to be as hard on himself as he is. If you look at his characters in real life and in Modern Romance and in Lost in America, I mean, Mother, I mean, they're all, he's so hard on himself. And I appreciate that quality. I mean, because so often it's the opposite in comedies, where you have comedians who are just saying, love me, love me, love me all the time with their actions. And that's not Brooks. He's always probing and always being difficult. It reminded me, basically, Modern Romance is, to me, the comic underside of Raging Bull. Like, it basically, his character in Modern Romance is a buttoned up version of Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull in terms of how he relates to women and how he processes his jealousy and obsession and resentment. I mean, all that is very present, just not in as physical a way.
I have a soft spot for Defending Your Life, which is,
oh, God, yeah.
I admit, maybe not like as titanic as some of the others, but it's,
no, that's great.
View of the afterlife as sort of this bureaucracy with all you can eat buffets is really funny. The idea that you have to go on trial for basically how dumb you were at various points in your life is tremendous. And mm-hmm. also he did something with Meryl Streep, and I don't know what it was, but I don't think she's ever been more engaging, charismatic, attractive as the character she plays in that movie, who's like not tremendously developed. She's just basically a very nice, good-hearted woman, but she really pops in that film for some reason.
No, oh, I think that was just him being perceptive. I mean, from what the way he tells it is that he went to a party that Meryl Streep was at, and this is how she was, and he wanted to see the version of Meryl Streep that he met at a party in a movie, and which he hadn't seen, and that's what you see in Defending Your Life. I'm someone who's just effervescent and charming, and I think deeply romantic too. I think I love it. I think Defending Your Life is a wonderful movie. You know, as far as romantic comedies go, I mean, it's there are not too many that are better than that one.
No funny accent. No. Devil Wears Prada stuff. She's just there,
she's
but
just
it's
she's
so
her.
Engaging.
Yeah, and she's done that a little bit more recently. I feel like that, like Defending Your Life, kind of kicked off another phase in her career where she's able to be. I mean, we saw it in Ricky and the Flash too. I mean, Ricky and the Flash. I mean, I guess she is playing, you know, a character who's been through, had some hard knocks, and you know, a middle aged rocker, and has all the signs of that. But that's still just it's a very natural performance, and from an actress who was associated with anything but who was always talking, who you always thought about as having a process, and you know, and somebody who would put on a lot of different accents and play characters from around the world, and you know, you never really got a sense of who Meryl Streep herself might be, and Defending Your Life gave you that look. I mean, Mother is a good one too, that I, you know, and all of them have moments that I think about all of the time. You know, I think about the hotel that Brooks stays in comparison to Meryl Streep's hotel. It's like, come to the Continental, we can paint it or something like that. You know, it, just like thinking about whenever I think about, like, you know, what do you deserve out of this life? Like, what have you done to deserve what it is that you get? And Defending Your Life is a film that reflects on that question pretty thoroughly. I really love it. And and I just like, you know, have you seen Mother as well? Have you seen
yes.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, Mother's a tough movie. I mean, like, the experiment that he's trying to do, and what he comes away with, you know, it's hard on her. It's hard on his mom. and you know, the revelation at the end about her ambitions and how she had to table them in order to be a wife and mother, and how that, you know, explains a certain level of resentment. I mean, these are tough observations that you don't expect, you know, out of a comedy sometimes. You know, it's particularly in the third act when things are supposed to, you know, resolve themselves in a happy way. It's you put you through a little bit.
And on a much more trivial level, whenever I go to the freezer and get a thing of ice cream that's been in there too long,
yeah,
I think, oh, it's got protective ice on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Or any line at a store. It's just, you know, it's, you think about his mother talking about the depression, and him saying, it's the 90s, mother, it's fancy jam time. It's a great line. I think that he deserves more critical respect. I know that he's respected, you know, and he's a comic, and people adore him, but I think as a filmmaker he deserves even more respect than he's getting, and I hope that Lost in America is just the start of that, and that Criterion or whoever goes back and really gives his other work the TLC it deserves.
It's awesome that he picked you, and I was going to say, and so I can look forward to Akira Kurosawa picking me for some of his, but too late. I should have been friends with Akira Kurosawa. Now, and I don't mean to imply by that at all that was the only reason you got it, was this acquaintance that you had with him. No,
that's just the way it kind of turned out. I can say vaguely that I did well enough to where they want they've assigned me to something else. So
good.
So I'm happy that it wasn't just a one-time favor to Albert Brooks, that they looked at what I did for them and wanted more on someone else. So I can't really say what that is yet, but that should be coming down the pipeline later this year.
They already have what is probably my all-time favorite film, which is Preston Sturges' Sullivan's Travels. So it can't be that one, but maybe it'll be another that I appreciate.
I name-check Sullivan's Travels in my Lost in America essay, actually.
Well, that's appropriate.
That, another grand experiment, involving the road and finding yourself, touching Indians, etc.
And it starts out with an RV too, although he ditches it fairly quickly.
He does.
So I don't want to keep you up, being that you have other errands to get about, no doubt. But so let me just put you on the spot one more time before we call it quits here. If you were nose deep in the baseball season, if you really thought the Cubs were going to repeat, and you don't know what kind of a risk I am taking pronouncing them dead right here, because if they jump off the table, and I hope they do, I don't think they will, but I hope they do. I'm going to eat these words on Twitter over and over and over again. If you haven't seen a movie this summer, what movie that you've missed? It could be anything. It could be anything from as wide a release as Wonder Woman or Spider-Man. It could be something totally obscure. What do you need to get out of the house right now during this All-Star break, which lasts through Thursday? What do you need to get out and see?
At this point, I gotta think Baby Driver is the one. And if you want to go something for something smaller, I'd probably keep an eye out for a film called A Ghost Story, which is coming out pretty soon in a limited way, and then it'll expand beyond that.
I'm intrigued by that one, which is literally a ghost in a sheet, as I understand it.
Yeah, you've given too much away already.
Have I? Okay. All right. Well, that's what's commonly available.
But no, it's an interesting one, and I mean, it's certainly not your standard ghost story. In fact, you may maybe see Personal Shopper too while you're at it, which is also a ghost story that is totally unconventional. The Olivier Assayas film that Kristen Stewart stars in, that's on iTunes or whatever if you want to rent it or something. But that's a very surprising and unexpected movie too.
And that's the same director who made The Clouds of Sils Maria with her, right?
Correct. He's amazing. Yeah, Assayas has been making great movies for a very long time, and it's the same guy. And I think she is definitely his muse. And there's a lot of the two films do share quite a bit.
Well, I love that one, I don't want to keep you for another hour. I'd start going into details of that one, but that was a tremendous picture as well. So I'll look forward to that. Scott, thank you very much for taking the time, and well, look forward to talking to you on the regularly level over at Oscilloscope Musings.
Yeah.
And look forward to the next picture podcast continuing.
Yeah. And of course, I assume you should mention that you have a pretty huge piece of your own coming up on the Musings site on Errol Flynn and the rise and quick fall of the swashbuckler, which is a great piece, as usual, from you, and a nice, such a great balance of history and analysis, and I really love it, and hope to get some eyes on it.
And thanks so much for mentioning that and for giving me the chance to do it. And man, if only I could write the Criterion. I don't know, some Errol Flynn. He would never make it though. I don't think his films would ever get into the Criterion collection.
Didn't Adventures of Robin Hood get in there?
There's a Warner's release that's about at the Criterion level in terms of extras and restoration and stuff, but I don't think they've picked anything up, and that would be the one.
That would be the one for sure. So it's gorgeous.
So,
well, I'll put in the good word. see how far that goes.
I thank you very much. Once again, thanks for coming by.
All right, thank you.
Leapin' Lizard, we have come to the end of another episode. You can follow Scott Tobias at Twitter at Scott_Tobias. Very basic but effective. You can follow me at GoStephenGoldman. Or you can just go to San Diego. I hear it's really nice there. Scott writes for more publications than I can economically list, but they're all worth seeking out. And in the meantime, the site that he edits is musings.oscilloscope.net. And you can also listen to The Next Picture Show at the podcatcher of your choice, and you should subscribe and rate them, as I would hope you would subscribe and rate this one too. It's the best way to show your appreciation, as it helps bring the kind of attention that sustains a podcast in this dog-eat-dog world. No sponsors to report, so we'll just say that this episode was brought to you by the number 24. Speaking of dogs, our producer thought that he took that meeting to talk about adoptions. Kitten adoptions, cute, cuddly, orphan kittens, mew, mew. Well, who am I kidding? Put the cuffs on him, take him away. Our theme song, The Infinite Man, which you have heard throughout this episode and in fact are hearing now, was composed by myself and Dr. Richard Mooring. At last check, his name was on over 11 patents, but none of them for what used to be politely called marital aids. Well, if Aaron Judge doesn't fall so deeply in love with the home run derby he refuses to leave Miami, I'll be back next week with Jesse Spector, and he and I will have more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.